Accession number 4800, rail number 2.
Reel 2, Squadron Leader Manfield. Squadron Leader, you had a long tour at Abercare for over 5 years, and of course now you were fully fledged, weren't you?
This is so, but I think I owe my feathers, as one might say, to the fact that I was an extremely lucky man in that I went into a world of ex-Halton boys. I was the only man entrant who worked in ERS. All the rest of the personnel there were ex-Halton boys who had passed out round about 1928 and would therefore have joined the RAF in about 1926. Therefore, their experience and their know-how was of tremendous assistance to me. They took me into their fold and I consider moulded my service image and personality. True, for the first year I was not allowed to say a great deal, the comment being if I opened my mouth, get some in, meaning get some service in, or get your knees brown, which meant that I had only just come overseas and that my knees were not yet brown. This, of course, is the way in which the service worked, largely. You constantly found that you were going from one unit to another, and in each case, you found that the whole of your life changed in that you became a different person, your life was different, and you had to make a fresh start in a new pond.
Sport was always a big thing in the service. Did you get involved very much with it?
Yes, I did in the Middle East. This is where I started my sporting career, because I hadn't played any games as a youngster, and until this time I had not had an opportunity to partake in any games. But here in the Middle East at that time, a tremendous amount of sport was indulged in, the whole range from yachting to cricket, even rugby. Rugby was played on aerodromes full of camel thorn, and the pitch was made by pouring waste engine oil, which was largely castor, onto the sand to bind it together so that one had a pitch on which to play. There was plenty of swimming, of course, and we had two beaches at Abukir, Western Beach and Brighton Beach, which were about a mile away from huts, and the bathing accommodation was B cases. These were cases in which aircraft fuselages came out from UK and they were then used as changing huts. We also had a yacht club where the boats were built by the airmen themselves and to a one design, and we had one design racing, and occasionally a strange boat would appear, occasionally from Alexandria Yacht Club. Someone found some money and was able to buy one, and these were a little larger, and I suppose the fleet was somewhere about 25 to 30 boats.
Did you go into Alexandria? Was this part of an airman's social life in those days?
Yes, one occasionally went to Alexandria. The main occasion one went was at the end of a quarter. In those days, airmen were given a clothing allowance, and if you were careful with your clothing and didn't purchase any during that quarter, a certain amount of credit was given to you, and on credit payday, then the airman would go to Alexandria. If you went out whilst the sun was up, you went out in slacks and tunic, drill slacks and tunic, and a topi, and you carried your blue peak cap in your topi case, which was a canvas arrangement, with you. You also wore on your belt an entrenching tool helve. When the sun went down, you religiously took off your topi, put on your peak cap, and put the topi in the case which you had. We used to go to Alexandria because movies, talkies had just arrived at about that time, and there was a cinema in Alexandria which showed talkies. The usual move was down to Alexandria, into the Anglo-American, to have a ham roll and a beer, then to the cinema, then back to the Anglo-American to have another ham roll and a beer, and then back on the train to Abukir. There is one thing I would like to mention here. In Egypt, we were paid in piastres, 10 piastre pieces on pay parade. And this rather unique thing happened here, that when you went to the pay table to draw your money, the money was paid to you onto a marble slab to see if the 10 piastre pieces rang, because once you left the table with the money in your hand, there was no going back and say that it was dud, because there was a tremendous amount of dud money at that time.
What were the relationships like with NCOs and warrant officers, or lead officers in those days?
Discipline was quite tight, and one did not see a great deal of officers. For example, in ERS, we had a flight lieutenant in charge who was most of the time in his office. Similarly, in the MTRS, which was the mechanical transport repair section, there was a flight lieutenant in charge of that, and the squadron commander was the squadron leader. One saw him on the weekly CO's parade, but apart from that, one didn't see a great deal of him.
Would he have known your name, do you think?
I think he would have done if you partook in sport, because he was very keen on sport and would always turn out to watch a game where any of his teams were involved. I think that he had the adage of a well-known Air Vice Marshal in mind, who said on one visit to our squadron, when he was AOC Middle East, this was Air Vice Marshal Bob Scarlett, said that he always liked to come to A squadron because he knew it was a good squadron, and any squadron that was good in sport was always good at its job. The NCOs, of course, we were a lot closer to, because they were working with us the whole time, and they took a great interest in what we were doing apart from work. Of course, there was always a senior NCO in charge of the huts in which you lived, and they were always coming around and checking up that life in the hut was correct and decent, and that the place was kept clean, and that we were behaving in a smart and airman-like manner.
Had you actually done any flying as yet?
No, I hadn't, but the opportunity did arise when I was at Abukir, we had in the section a sergeant who had been an instructor at 4FDS Abuswear, had finished his instructional time and was now working back on his basic job as a fitter. And he, of course, had to keep his hand in and do a certain amount of flying. I mentioned the fact to him one day that I had not yet flown, and he said, right, the next time that I am doing my monthly flying, you should fly with me. So what the day came, and he took me down to B Squadron, and I was issued with a parachute, and I clambered into the front seat of an Avro 504K, and the sergeant got into the back seat. We took off and flew along the coast for a while at, I suppose, about 1,000 to 1,500 feet, and then went a little higher over Alex Harbour. And the pilot told me over the Gosport tube, which was the means of communication then, to look down, and in the harbour I would see the Mediterranean fleet. This I did, and he said, well, we'll show them some flying. And before I knew what had happened, the nose of the aircraft had dropped away. I closed my eyes, and I suppose we looped. In effect, he told me subsequently that that's what we had just done. I rubbed my eyes over my goggles, and the oil which had come from the engine smeared, and from then on I saw nothing until such time as we landed back on the aerodrome. I also managed to fly a little more whilst in Egypt. Sports teams were transported around the Middle East in Victorias. These were notoriously sick-making aircraft because they couldn't get much above 1,000 feet. And at that height in Egypt in the summer, there's a tremendous amount of turbulence which makes one very sick indeed. And I spent most of my time, as did most of the other passengers, being violently ill.
5.5 years out in Egypt, as you've described it, with storekeeping and sport and a very occasional trip in the evening to Alexandria, seems rather a long period doing the same thing. Did you get homesick or find the time hanging very heavily on your hands and becoming bored?
No, I think that in the first 2 years one became a little homesick, particularly when, as with most parents or wives, they sent out the local paper, which used to arrive about a month after publication. But after that, it seemed that the UK was a long, long way away and was an entirely different world. As for being bored, one didn't become bored because there was so much to do. There was always something to look forward to. One was making progress in one's career. I sat trade test examination and became an LAC. Also, I was awarded my first good conduct badge, so I was now a trained airman in the true sense of the word.
Was the pay sufficient then to meet your needs as a fully trained airman in the service and perhaps even to save a little?
Yes, it was possible to save a little. I used to, in fact, make an allowance back to the UK to my mother. But there was no money for luxuries. Apart from, as I said before, at the end of the quarter, if you had been careful and had managed to get some credits against your name. But one must bear in mind at the same time that one had no outgoings as far as accommodation
was concerned, and we had to pay, it is true, 10 piastres a week for the extra messing. But apart from that, there were no overheads at all, and the money you received at the pay table was yours to do with as you wished.
It all seems to be a very happy period of your service, but when did you start looking forward to going back to the UK again?
Really, at the end of the fourth year, when one's name appeared on the preliminary warning roll. This was published with daily routine orders and showed the people who were due to go home within the forthcoming trooping season. And the trooping season for Egypt was normally from October to March. And the boat from Aboukir, actually from Alexandria, the one which took the Aboukir personnel was usually the last boat of the year, which was about March. Eventually, one heard that a troopship had left UK, which was coming into Alexandria, and then one started to count the days until such time as one would be embarking in Alexandria. And the day, these days were called days to go, and all over the unit one would see DTG 14, 7, 5, and eventually coming down to 1, which was the day of embarkation. And previous to, on the day previous to embarkation, there was always what was known as a boat do, and this meant going to the wet bar of the Naffy and having more than one's usual amount of McEwan's tops. If I might say here, they were called tops because the beer was so flat that you had to put lemonade in it to get anything of a head on it. And the next morning, picking up your two kit bags, accompanied by your colleagues who were soldiering on, and up to Aboukir Station, onto the train, and down to Alex Harbour. On boarding the troop ship, in my case it happened to be the Lancashire, the sister ship to the Somersetshire, we were on about 2 hours, and the first turn of the screw came and a tremendous cheer went up, and there is an old service saying that when the first turn of the screw happens, all debts are paid.
Well, obviously it was a very close brotherhood for a long period. Did you make enduring friends in that time?
Oh yes, certainly, many. In fact, I can give you an example. Soon after I came to live here, I checked up on a telephone directory, knowing that one of my old pals had lived in this area, and I rang him up. His lady wife came to the phone, and I asked if he lived there. I said, could I speak to him? He came to the phone, I gave him his regiment, his service number, and he said, who is that? I said, Sid Manfield. And he said, no, and we went on from there, and it was just as if it were yesterday instead of 40 years, and we have been in constant touch ever since.
And then he went back by troop ship to England, and after your disembarkation leave, you were posted to Tangmere, which was a fighter station, I think. Did you notice any big changes in the service when you got back?
Oh yes, tremendous changes were now beginning to take place. For example, breeches and putties had disappeared. We now had trousers, and we were allowed to wear black shoes. Of course, I was extremely lucky in being posted to Tangmere because this was considered to be one of the stations in the RAF. Largely, I suppose, because of the fact that it had two of the most famous fighter squadrons of the Royal Air Force there, number 1 squadron and number 43, whose exploits in the Battle of Britain, which came later, are very well known. And of course, a tremendous number of the people who were serving there, the pilots who were serving there, subsequently became very well known. The squadron commander of number 1 squadron was Squadron Leader Hill of the Road to Endor fame. He and Flight Lieutenant Evans in the First World War and a wonderful escape. We had Flight Lieutenant McAvoy, who subsequently reached very high rank. There was Squadron Leader Ray was the squadron commander of number 43 squadron, and there was also Pilot Officer Rosier, who also went on to high rank, and many of those young pilots who were serving there were lost in the Battle of Britain, and some of them became extremely well known as a result of their exploits in that battle.
You were a storekeeper again at Tangmere with the same sort of duties, I take it. But did you have any extra responsibilities now that you were getting on in seniority?
Yes, I did. I was the secretary of RAF Tangmere Rugby Club. This was a usual practice in the RAF in that one had an officer in charge of the sport, but invariably the organisation was carried out by other ranks, and this was quite general, in fact.
What was the next stage in your service career?
Well, after 2 years at Tangmere, two extremely happy years, I was then posted to RAF Station Harwell, which was one of the new stations, the new pattern stations, which had been built under the expansion scheme which was then taking place in the Royal Air Force. I was posted there as a corporal. When I got there, there were about 4 or 5 of us, and we operated from the guard room and were responsible for receiving all the equipment in to establish this station. For the first week or 10 days, there were no aircraft there, but we saw our first aircraft arrive, which were Hawker Audax or Hines, I can't remember which came over from Abingdon and Upper Hayford. I understand subsequently that what in fact had happened was that 3 aircraft, 1 flight from Upper Hayford and Abingdon, where there were existing squadrons, came over to form the nucleus of the squadrons which were formed at Harwell. The squadrons which were formed at Harwell were 105 with battles, 226 with battles, and 107 with short-nosed plenums. And these we equipped, and these were the squadrons which subsequently became part of the AASF.
The AASF being the Advanced Air Striking Force, which went to France, wasn't it?
That is correct.
This must have been particularly interesting because these battles and plenums were presumably the first of our relatively high-performance monoplanes coming into service. Did that all go quite smoothly?
To the best of my knowledge, it did, and there seemed to be no great troubles. I have a recollection of one senior officer who had heard that it was extremely difficult to get out of the back of a battle from the observer's position, because when the canopy was pulled down behind him, it prevented his getting out. And I remember seeing this battle from the window of my store, this battle rigged into a flying position and tied down, the engine running up, and this senior officer in the back coming out quite successfully onto a mattress which had been placed at the side on the ground.
May we know his name?
Well, squadron leader Geoffrey Tuttle, who was the OC-105 squadron, who subsequently became Air Marshal Sir Geoffrey Tuttle.
Were there any other distinguished people there, or distinguished visitors that you recall?
Yes, I remember two senior German officers coming on a visit to the station, Udet and Milch. And also in 1938, His Majesty the King, George VI, came on his visit, as he visited several stations at that time, and he paid a visit to RAF Harwell, and I had my first close view of a member of the royal family. After about a year, I was again posted overseas. I had volunteered for this because I had enjoyed my previous tour overseas, and I thought I would like to go overseas again. This time I was posted to Singapore, to number 230 GR squadron. And I was lucky in that I went to Singapore on a brand new ship as a civilian on the British India Line SS Amra, where we travelled as second-class passengers, which was a great change after having had two trips on a troop ship. The trip took us just over a month, and we arrived in Singapore on Christmas Day, 1938.
What sort of aircraft did 230 Squadron have?
230 Squadron had Sunderland flying boats, eight of them, and each of these was named after one of the Straits settlements. And, of course, being flying boats, they were anchored out in the Johor Strait, on the trot in Johor Strait. And this meant that a new element came into my life as a storekeeper now, in that there was a watery influence, in that it were dinghies. If you went out to a boat, it had to be a dinghy. And a lot of other expressions now came in, and ways of life generally associated with flying boats. They came up the slip, they went down the slip, and I held in stores the cruise kits which the flying boats took when they went away on their tours around Malaya and the islands of the Malayan archipelago.
And we're getting very near to the beginning of the war now, aren't we?
Yes, we are, and in fact, the day after war broke out, one of our boats was sent away on a mission, and I believe returned after an hour and a half through an oil leak, and the squadron commander took an extremely dim view of this and had us all on parade and said that this wasn't good enough, war had broken out, and the Tidapa spirit, as it is known in Malaya, that is the attitude of I couldn't care less, was dead. And so we went about our duties, but the next day a small coffin appeared together with a brass plate and a catafalque, and a funeral oration was read. Chinese crackers were let off for the firing squad, and Tidapa was laid to rest in a grave which is still existent, or was in 1951 at RAF Salita, next to the grave where the axe was buried between 201 and 205 squadrons.
Well, Squadron Leader Manfield, that brings us very nicely to the end of the era that...